What I'm seeing is we're like a bunch of electricians and we're wiring up the world for like Bitcoin, for a Bitcoin standard or hyper-Bitcoinization, but the power's not really on yet, right? The liquidity's not really there, the need isn't always fully there, but like the day the power goes on, like watch out, because once we run out of like, you know, we're pressing on the brakes, you know, with our these different like policies that we try and like stamp out the crises with, any of these communities, any of these 20, 30, 40 communities around the world that that are like maybe 30% Bitcoinized can go to 100% in like days.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with Andrew Begin, Director of Marketing at Galloy, a company building Bitcoin-native banking infrastructure for organizations. We talk about Galloy's Bitcoin projects, including the open-source Blink wallet, made popular through Bitcoin Beach in El Salvador. I learn about the vision for the product, as well as its stable sats functionality and how this works. We discuss the power of communities taking ownership of their financial infrastructure and the opportunities for grassroots Bitcoin adoption in Africa and Latin America. Finally, we talk briefly about permaculture and regenerative farming and the connections with Bitcoin thinking. If you have any questions or would like to reach out, my emails are always open, hello@thetransformationofvalue.com. If you would like to support the show, please consider leaving a review or boosting some sats via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show.
You know, it's funny, I only recently set this up. I used to play a lot of music, record music and stuff, so I had all the gear. But only maybe 6 months ago did I finally say, okay, let me set it up, let me get the proper setup going. And if I showed you what's outside of this little podcast booth, you'd be like, oh man, I'm in a basement. And so I've set myself up to have a decent setup.
Yeah, no, that's cool. You are, you do a bit of music, you say?
Yeah, back in like 2010 or so, I lived in San Diego. I was learning guitar and I had some friends who were pretty accomplished musicians and would play out and around. And so I started playing with them and then eventually like got addicted to it, fell down that music rabbit hole. And for 3 or 4 years, I used to gig out and play bars and, you know, do cover gigs and original music and stuff. And so it was a great time. I don't play that often these days with two kids and whatnot and a startup job. But I recently was in El Salvador for adopting Bitcoin, and they had the Satoshi Rakamoto there, which you may have seen, where they, you know, they get a back line and anybody who hops up can play. And I got to hop on stage and play a couple tunes. So I love music. I've recently been starting to get back into it, and I like to see the Bitcoiner scene that, you know, is interfacing and crossing paths with music a little bit. You know, DJ Satoshi has a Saturday night Twitter space, which is like an open mic and stuff. And so I'm trying to get my music chops back.
You might have seen, there's a Kiwi girl, Tip, who does the rapping.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Great stuff. That's really cool. And have you found, like, just generally with creative work, like how does that connect with Bitcoin? And I hope we can talk a little bit about what you're working on at the moment, but like, have you seen sort of crossover or interesting connections there?
Yeah, of course. It's funny when I speak to somebody, and I mean like maybe extended family, or like I meet somebody who, and they're like, oh, you work in Bitcoin, is that FTX? Or, you know, and they're very like, and the surface, you know, a lot of times what I'll say is like, Bitcoin is the most interesting thing that I've come across since I learned music. But there are parallels, because like music is built on math, or you can reduce music to math and principles of, you know, physics and things like this. And I think that at the base layer, that is an interesting parallel to Bitcoin, which is that like it has really, really strong sound principles that are make it what powerful. Or reasons for it being powerful. And then beyond that, I think that I saw somebody like tweeting about this or something today, like Bitcoin, it was probably American HODL, but something like, you know, Bitcoin, the journey of learning about Bitcoin makes you kind of question and dig a little deeper into everything. And it also, I think, results in you becoming a little bit more genuine version of yourself, because you think, I believe that you zoom out a little bit and you think more about, you know, low time preference, long time horizon, and meaning, you know, and so I do think it parallels with creative work really well.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. So I'm keen to dive into a little bit about what you're working on at the moment, Andrew. So your work with Galoi, Blink, these different projects. So like, how would you, it's sort of one of those questions, you know, you go to a party and you try and introduce what you do. And I know what it's like trying to explain what I do, but let's give it our best shot here. What is it that you do here, Andrew, and what are you working on at the moment?
Sure. You know, for me, I'm a non-technical person. I'm not a developer. I've been working at Galoi for about 2.5 years, and one of the few non-technical members of the team. And so what I do is, I mean, I wear many hats, but I think at the core of it, it's really community building, and that comes to life in many different ways, but it's like building relationships and convening people around the mission, right? Like a lot of times what we say is like, oh, okay, I work on Bitcoin at this company, or I work for Bitcoin at this company. And that's how I feel like my job is to help drive Bitcoin adoption forward. And I'm privileged to be able to do that by working at Galoi, which is a company building open source infrastructure for that allows, you know, organizations to launch Bitcoin applications and products that are, you know, very, you know, highly available, secure, et cetera, et cetera. And I also get to work on, you know, the first thing that was ever built on the Galoi stack is the Bitcoin Beach. It was called the Bitcoin Beach Wallet in 2020, and now it's called Blink. And it is the best wallet for bottom-up Bitcoin adoption, you know. And so it's just an amazing, I just feel so privileged to be able to work, like, first of all, with the people I work with at Galoi and Blink. But secondarily, you know, the people who are building Bitcoin circular economy projects and community projects who have decided that Blink is just an awesome tool for them to use, I'm in contact with them on a daily basis. And so, you know, many of the projects that you've heard about, like Bitcoin Ikasi or Bitcoin Jungle or Bitcoin Lake, or, you know, and many of the projects that you may not have heard about or have only heard in passing or may hear about by, you know, next year. That's probably medium-winded version of the answer, but we can go in whichever direction from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. So I tried out Blink Wallet, downloaded it, had a go. I really liked it. I love the integration with the map of Bitcoin merchants, and I like the approach, the way that it's built on this open source stack and this kind of approach of community building, which you talk about, and that's something that's really close to my heart. You know, looking at sort of the community in New Zealand and different places that I've been visiting, trying to see how these things emerge. And I think the idea of a wallet that is for a community, there's something, some sort of a sense of ownership there. Obviously anyone can use it, but it's designed with a certain community in mind. I thought that was really powerful. So talking a little bit more about that, what's the long-term vision for the Blink wallet and sort of that community building aspect?
Sure. So a little bit of history. So Blink used to be called the Bitcoin Beach Wallet, and it was built in 2020. So Bitcoin Beach, the project in El Salvador that many, you know, most Bitcoiners, you know, are very familiar with, and maybe many have visited. But this project started in 2019, and it was born out of an existing program that had been going for 10 years, which was essentially to help keep kids out of gangs, provide opportunity for locals to learn English, learn computer classes. And they decided, okay, let's try to, they received a donation and they decided, let's try to build a circular economy where people are earning Bitcoin, merchants are accepting Bitcoin, people are spending a Bitcoin. You know, Nicolas, the founder of Galoi, and you know, the early team, saw this project and they were working to build a wallet, and they said, wow, this would be a perfect place to go to get like real world on the ground insight about what people need when they're using the Lightning Network, you know. And And so the Bitcoin Beach Wallet was built on the ground, and it was built for the purpose of being a daily like spending wallet, right? It's custodial, as you mentioned, it's built on open source code, and then there the features that kind of mark Blink really show the merchant use cases or the community spending use cases. So you mentioned the map. That was really important in the early days, and it still is today. The communities that are adopting today are like Hyperdrive, because all the ground has been laid. So there's a community project called Berlin in El Salvador, and they have like in less than a year over 100 merchants accepting Bitcoin, and they have expats living there from all over the world. Actually, an Aussie or was he a New Zealand? I forget where he's from.
There's a Kiwi couple, Nikki and James, who are out in Berlin as well.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. And many people have flocked there. And they even said the map feature, which we mentioned. Once you get like five merchants in a town on the map, you go to the sixth one and you say, hey, like, we're looking for places to spend Bitcoin. Here's five places. Would you like to be added to the map? And it's like, yeah, like, I want to be there too, right? And that was, so it's a nice tool for the community. And in the early days, it was really interesting to see, like static QR codes, because if you're selling snow cones or hot dogs on the street, you may not have a good internet connection. And so even in those early days, you know, we had what would now be LNURL. Before then, I think it was just a encoded URL to open up the Blink wallet, but you'd have a QR code. And so all of these use cases were born out of that real world experience. And, you know, if you listen to Mike Peterson, you know, one of the founders of Bitcoin Beach Project, he would, you know, they'd talk about how you have to, if you want somebody to use new technology, you have to make it simpler than what they're doing today, right? And so if somebody made me a pupusa and I could put a dollar down on the table or 50 cents on the table and walk away, that's actually pretty easy. And now if I'm asking the merchant to wash their hands, take out their phone, tap it a bunch of different times to create a lightning invoice, yeah, that's actually more difficult than accepting cash. So having something like that static QR code was something really important in the merchant use case, and on and on and on. And some of the other things that have made it their way to the app more recently are stable sats, which is it essentially works like a stable coin, but there's no token involved and it's completely lightning interoperable and it's very inexpensive. It's all sats. We could talk about that if we want to go into it. It uses trading to hold that stable value, but that's really important too, because if you're in Latin America, you're in Africa, and you're trying to get people to use Bitcoin, if they accept $50 one day and they turn around and wake up the next day and it's now $40, like, they don't have, you know, expendable cash to be able to deal with that short-term volatility. So stable sats was key in that use case. And all of these features, I mean, essentially the Blink is built to be a tool for bottom-up Bitcoin adoption, and it continues to do so. And so we're very we're listening to the communities, and, you know, in the early days it was a couple communities, and now it's 20, right? And people in Honduras and in various countries in Africa and around the world that are using the wallet in their own ways and providing feedback about what's working or what they need. You know, because it's open source, you've seen, Bitcoin Jungle, which is a community in Costa Rica. They have an app that's basically, it's a fork of the Bitcoin Beach Wallet. They forked it in very early, like late 2021 or early 2022, and they built their version. And we would love to see more of that. It's not so easy today. You need to have a pretty savvy team of developer or two that really understands the stack and stuff like that to do it, but in the future we hope, you know, there to be many different wallets built on the Galloway stack. So
I want to circle back to stable sats in a moment, but I just coming back to the original connection with El Salvador, and you talk about Nicolas Berti, the CEO of Galloway. How did that connection originally emerge with Latin America? Did you guys go in and think, hey, we want to build something here alongside what's happening in Bitcoin Beach? Or was there more of a personal connection with some of the people who are already working on Bitcoin Beach? Like, what was that origin story there like?
Yeah, so the story goes actually that Mike Peterson went on an early Tales from the Crypt and or What Bitcoin Did episode. And I think in one of these episodes, I forget which one, I don't even know if it was called Bitcoin Beach yet. It was like youth programs in El Salvador and Bitcoin, right? And there was also a Forbes article, and the specific timeline is missing it right now in my brain, they learned about the project, Bitcoin Beach, and said, that's interesting, we have to reach out, and actually kind of quote unquote, you know, cold called and said, hey, we just want to learn about what you guys are doing. And then second of all, maybe we can help because we're doing something that is, works together, you know, with what you guys are doing down
there. Yeah. I think I've actually read a document or sort of outlining that original youth development plan that you mentioned, because I recall there being some connection there around just, you know, as the community was trying to move on from a lot of this gang violence, and that there was something there. And so that's kind of those two things came together, and Bitcoin has played a pivotal role in helping develop that. So that's really cool. Coming back to stable sats, I did have some questions here. So someone tweeted, stable sats, not stable coins. And I think a lot of us maybe feel a bit ambiguous or unsure about what stable coins mean, given some of the issues around centralization, some of the issues with things like Tether and other stable coins where people think, oh, I don't know. And obviously there is a use case in Latin America for that price stability. But what are the risks here? Is there a counterparty risk? What is the machination of stable sats, and how does it provide guarantees or certainty that it's good to go?
Yeah, I mean, nothing is guaranteed except for satoshis in your cold storage with keys that only you hold, right?
Yeah.
The tongue-in-cheek, you know, thing that I said one day was like, once you stabilize Satoshi, some of the magic wears off, right? And so, to break it down, there is counterparty risk, right? Like the way that stable sats is currently running is essentially a hedging or a trading engine where you take short positions and hold Bitcoin so that if the price of Bitcoin goes down, you're in money and short position, and the price of Bitcoin goes up, you hold sats, right? And this is a concept that actually Arthur Hayes of BitMEX has been writing about since 2016. So the idea is not new, but we were one of the first to execute and put it like into production, into people's hands. Right now, the dealer uses OKX, so it is a centralized exchange. Essentially, with any sort of stable coin or any asset that, again, that is not sats in cold storage, you're essentially saying, okay, there is counterparty risk. Now, what is it? And you know, why would I choose one thing over another? And so with this, it's kind of like without banking integration. And so, you can have account, in OKX. And one of the ways that it works is that, a trade is not being made by every time a customer of Blink moves $5 into stable sats, but rather there's a engine and a team that is managing, the exposure and the stability of the stable sats. And it's an open source project. And so, there's a couple things that we've done some work on and are thinking about further. So one of the things is a multi-exchange to reduce risk, right? So right now it's OKX, but you could have run it with OKX and, insert exchange A, B, and C alongside, right? To de-risk that, or to de-risk the impact of, say, an exchange having an issue.
Yeah.
And then another exciting sort of idea for it is using DLCs, so discrete log contracts, right? Which 10101 has an app that's doing this. And we've looked into it as well. And I think that Elon Musk has just had an announcement that they're going in this direction. So when we launched stable sats about a year and a half ago, the decision to go with OKX was the one of the deciding factors was the available liquidity, right? Because you're able to continue to provide stable sats as a product so long as there's liquidity, so long as there's somebody to have execute the trade. And so the liquidity was there, but I'm personally pretty excited about what the people are doing with stable USD, synthetic USD on DLCs and stuff like that. And you know, I think that the other key thing is that you know, you as a user, as a company, you know, is having tools or having options available to you, right? So, you know, some people think, okay, I want to use a stablecoin, but okay, stablecoins are, you know, you have a token and you're also interfacing with Ethereum, Tron, you know, and you know, other networks to be able to use that, right? With stable sats, it is only Satoshis, right? And so there is no banking connection to it. You can't like send it to your bank account and convert my synthetic dollars to, you know, to physical USD. Rather, you pay an invoice from your dollar balance, and it's converted to Satoshis, and Satoshis get sent out. So it is that just incredible like use case of just to say, I'm a merchant, I'm selling, you know, my product, and I don't want to be stomaching the you know, 8, 10, 30% swings on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. I just want to know what's there because I have to buy more product on Friday. And the feedback on it has been like just amazing because, I mean, not a ton of people, you know, there's people that use it that want to use it and find a huge like value in that. And then there's people that are like, oh, I just, Bitcoin is my stable coin, right? Or whatever, like, you know, one Satoshi is one Satoshi, like I'll insert all of these ideas. But it is, yeah, it's an alternative to, you know, to using stable coins for sure.
Yeah. So sorry, just to drill into that a bit more. So I've played around with Blink. I haven't had a chance to use the stable sats function though. So how does that work in the sense that you sort of store it in the stable sat and then you pull it back into Satoshis when you want to spend, or can you actually send it like you would with a, you know, a stable coin as we think about it? Like, how does that functionality work?
Yeah, so you can essentially in the wallet, you have two accounts. You have a Bitcoin account and a stable sats account. And you can set a default. You can say, when I receive, you know, when somebody sends me money, you know, I receive to stable sats or Bitcoin. You can obviously, you know, change on an invoice by invoice basis. But you can receive to your stable sats account. You can also choose to spend from your stable sats account. And so, you know, say I went to a Bitcoin, you know, event or a merchant. I went to the butcher. I buy a steak. He's using BTC Pay server, or he's using, you know, whatever wallet he's using. He's using Phoenix, right? And he creates an invoice for $20 worth of Satoshis. I can choose to pay that from my stable sats account, and my stable sats balance will get deducted, and the trade will happen at that time, right? Because the idea is, you know, if I move $50 to my stable sats account, no matter what the Bitcoin price is doing, that is staying $50 until I spend $20 worth of Bitcoin, and then that'll be $30, right? And whatever that conversion rate is going to happen at the time of purchase. Yeah. And so you're
I see what you mean. So you're using the Lightning Network, but it's just that kind of at the end points, there's a conversion happening. So it's quite different.
So to speak, dollars at rest, you know, and then sats in flight, exactly.
Dollars at rest. Yeah, I like that, because I think that clarifies for me just sort of that difference with a stable coin where you're actually relying on some other network to actually make the transaction happen, and there's a whole lot of risk there. But what you're talking about, it's really, yeah, dollars at rest. I like it. So that's a cool functionality. And in terms of one more thing on that, so when people want to use that feature, is there any fees or anything associated with that conversion process? How does that work?
Yeah, so right now there's no fee. There's a 0.2% spread on the exchange, and so it's extremely low for comparing to, you know, exchanging, you know, dollars for sats. Yeah, it's extremely reasonable and low. And you know, but it matters. I mean, a lot of the people that are using the wallet are, you know, there are many different worlds apart that use Bitcoin, right? And you know, in many areas of the world, you know, 15, 20, 30 sats, I'm like paying attention to those sats, and like, you know, do I want to spend that? When do I want to spend that? And so we're trying at this time, you know, it's supposed to be just easy. We're trying to help drive Bitcoin adoption. And so the 0.2% spread is kind of where the, you know, a good level is at this point.
Yeah, no, that's cool. And look, I fully understand, my background is, design and UX and stuff as well. And I understand the importance of making that easy to engage with and, making it accessible. And I'm curious, we're talking about stable sats here as a US dollar base. Has there been any deployments in other currencies?
So my understanding is that you don't have the liquidity to be running a similar product, like trading pair wise, to do it in other currencies. Maybe it's possible to do with like a euro, like a synthetic euro or something like this, but my understanding is that it's not really feasible or maybe more reasonable to end up running to doing that. So it's not like technically it's, I think it's possible, but it's just not enough like demand to be using that hedging engine or in the same way that you would doing it with the dollar. We have display currency in the app, right? And so you can set your display currency to be whatever you want. You can say, I want to see my value in South African rand. I want to see my value in the Nigerian naira, right? And I'm holding synthetic dollars, a dollar balance. I believe that if you're holding like a naira or the Turkish lira, or you're looking at it in that in that currency, you're like, your value is actually going up over time
Yeah.
because you're holding the dollars and not your own.
Yeah, that's interesting because I mean, again, from a New Zealand perspective, I think there's been recent talk about a New Zealand stable coin that's come out, which is problematic in its own right, just the kind of the corporate background behind that project. But I'm wondering here, is this vehicle for stable sats almost a way of getting kind of dollarization in other countries as well, because I certainly think, having US dollars even in New Zealand is a real positive. And so presenting the balance, say, in a local currency, but actually the foundation is the US dollar. That is an interesting kind of game theoretical around kind of the spread of US dollar, even say Europe, Australasia, different parts of the world. So it's just, I thought that was interesting.
It's really interesting. And the other thing is like there's many applications of stable sats like product, for enterprise usage or otherwise. I mean, we're focusing on a use case which is a main segment. I mean, there's many different types of users of Blink, all the way up to hardcore maxis who just want to have a simple wallet that they can rely upon when they're traveling or something. But a significant user is either unbanked, underbanked, like coming to like Bitcoin or the Lightning Network is their first, like in El Zante, it was their first experience with digital payments, right? And so you're bringing technology to areas that have been left out of the banking system completely. But you're bringing it to them in a way that can swing 20% one way or the other, right? And so having stable sats in the wallet, like there's many interesting angles to it, but I think at the core it's like, okay, bring somebody something that they can bring them something they can hold on to, on a day-to-day basis because they've got to make it to Friday and pay their rent with the money that they earned, and they may not have easy on-ramps and off-ramps. And so yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, I think so. There is obviously that use case, Latin America, Africa, different parts of the world that really are at the ends of, in terms of banking access, there's some real challenges there. But I think coming back though to even some of these other places such as New Zealand, where it's an interesting dynamic here. Everyone sort of tends to think New Zealand and Australia are, somehow there's one big country, but we are a separate country. But the real big challenge is that our banking system is primarily Australian owned, thanks to some things that happened in the 1980s. And so all of New Zealand's major banks, including the banks that the government uses in New Zealand, are Australian owned. And so there's actually a real lack of innovation happening. And a lot of people notice when they visit New Zealand and think, man, what's going on? These banks, the kind of the systems, the technology is actually really behind. And we've seen a surge recently in things like Wise and Revolut have become very popular as kind of neo banks because they're just cutting edge technology compared to what's available from your high street banks in New Zealand. And so I wonder here, in terms of, again, their access to US dollar stable sats, the kind of the ease of use, I mean, do you follow or look at what's happening with some of these neobanks and sort of the way they handle stuff on the fiat side as kind of an indicator of what consumers are after, maybe in slightly more developed countries? Like, how do you see that all working?
Yeah, I think that there's enough. So I'll say is like Galloway and Blink, right? So Galloway is between Galloway and Blink, we have like 20 people, many of which are developers, and we have a to-do list, that could go all the way out the room. And so we're kind of focused really at the core on the essentially the bottom up adoption in communities that are trying to like improve their community through Bitcoin and have found Bitcoin as well as Blink to be a tool to do so. And so while we have users all over the world and we listen to, listening to everybody and everything else, that's kind of the, at least the where my mind is, pretty focused, because we see a lot of growth and a lot of excitement and a lot of progress. One community or one project that I didn't mention was run by actually an NGO called Motive in Peru, and they're connecting people in the Peruvian Andes who, I mean, it's these villages. Joe Nakamoto went there, and he did a documentary, and there's been a couple folks going down there to do some filming, and they're using Blink, very heavily. And so, I kind of keep one eye, focused on or listening to what the sort of, quote unquote first world or developed nations and but honestly, like, being somebody who's from the States, like I want to go where people get Bitcoin immediately and where it's needed. It's like it's very, I think, satisfying to you go to Namibia or Uganda or something like this, and people are like, I get it. We're going. It's not like, oh, how are you better than the fintech app that I'm using, right? Which is, I think, what I face with like friends and people in the States. It's like, oh, we have this. And you mentioned in New Zealand, there's some a little bit of, I don't know if technological debt is not the right word, but a little left behind in terms of banking. So from a UX perspective, I kind of keep an eye on the fintech space, but yeah, we're focused a little bit more on the sort of the Latin America, African markets.
Oh, no, that's cool. And I guess the reason I bring that up, just yesterday we was celebrating, I don't know if celebrating is the right word for it, but we have a public holiday called Waitangi Day in New Zealand, which is one, think of it as the foundational document of New Zealand, signed in 1840 between the Maori and the British. And that sort of outlined this relationship that led to the formation of New Zealand. And it's a great time to reflect on sort of the role of the sovereignty of the Maori people in New Zealand, and sort of the way that all works. And it really, one of the interesting aspects of that is sort of the way that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, the central bank, has effectively got it has a monopoly on banking. And then you've got these commercial banks, which are Australian owned, so they're offshore. And something I've talked about a lot on this show is the real opportunity for the Maori people and the tribes, who are, they're very, they're developed, that we're all integrated and we live together and we're in cities and communities, but there is still a tribal identity. And so I'm very interested in things like Blink, things like Whetī as well, just the opportunities that that presents to empower the Maori people of New Zealand who are, in many cases, they're running forestry, they're running farms, they're running small communities, circular economies, but they're situated within a relatively developed country. And so it's not spoken about hugely in the Bitcoin space, but I certainly see some connections there, and I'm really passionate. And there's certainly a few friends of mine who are Bitcoiners in New Zealand who see opportunities there, because that kind of role of the banking system of the state in the lives of these tribes, which is not really what they signed up for with the Treaty of Waitangi. It's sort of, there's certainly a conversation there that I'm interested in exploring.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a guy, Yehudi Castro. He was like an advisor to the president of Colombia, I think, at some point or in some position like this. And I remember he was in an interview. He was interviewed on TV. I think this was not long after El Salvador made Bitcoin legal tender, and he said something to the effect of, you know, people were like, well, why is it? What's the benefit here? And he was like, well, the benefit is for the people, right? And so if we focus on the benefit of the people, like the banks can either reinvent themselves or we will reinvent banking for them or something like this. And I just like, I love that perspective, because if you have a tool that you know can improve, you know, the lives of people, and you're building that, like, you know, I do believe that, you know, as much as Elizabeth Warren tries to pretend like it's not happening, like, I believe that good people will continue to come on board and learn, like, you know what, like, this, there's actually a world changing technology here that is actually better to think about the benefits of it than to try and fight against it. And so you know, it's really cool to be working on, and that I would love to dig into the story about the Maori people as well, because you see that in, you know, the Peru is an example, in Guatemala there's, you know, in many areas of the world where people have been displaced or otherwise, you know, put onto some of the fringes. You know, there's in Kenya, there's a sort of a, I don't know if slum is the right word. There's a, you know, called Kibera. And I know that, you know, some of my friends over there are going in there and teaching Bitcoin and bringing access. And it's like, man, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but the fact that all you need is you don't even need a smartphone anymore. We used to say all you need is a smartphone, and now all you need is a Nokia, like, you know, 8610 or whatever, and you can use Machin Kura to send sats, and it's just like, it's so cool.
Yeah, well, those things are indestructible as well, so it's quite cool. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, again, though, for me it comes back to community, Andrew, and I think that I mean, this is longer term stuff, but, you know, like, what if, you know, we're sort of going for a hypothetical here, but what does a Maori Bitcoin wallet look like that they can use in their circular economy? They can use, and it's interoperable with other wallets. You know, I see that kind of ownership and that kind of branding aspect being really important, because there's necessarily something quite colonial and oppressive about using an Australian owned bank in New Zealand, because we don't have our own that are any good. There's something very oppressive about having to use something like Wise, because all of the banks in New Zealand don't have the features that you expect from a modern banking infrastructure. And look, I mean, it functions, it's stable. It's not, I'm not trying to paint it like it's an unstable system. It's just things take a long time to arrive on the island, let me put it that way. And so an opportunity to work with that. And so I'm curious to just talk a bit more, coming back to Blink. And you say, you know, obviously it's open source. It takes a little bit of work to get that stack stood up and working. But in terms of that process, like, what does that look like? Is that something Galois is able to support? Like, how does a community take that code base and deploy it for themselves?
Yeah. So today, you either need the team or funding, right? So Galois, you know, part of the sort of revenue model for Galois is to provide services to companies that want to build on the Galois stack, right? That is that's a natural, you know, service. But you know, if you're launching a community, sort of a bottom up grassroots community project, you're not exactly, you know, in most cases, going to be saying, well, first things first, let's like let's spend a bunch of money to get, you know, a wallet stood up, especially with the you know, many of the communities, like I mentioned, that, like, if your community has been on the fringe or left out in some way of the banking system, you know, the first thing you're not going to do is spend a bunch of money on software, like implementing software or building, you know, your own on your own stack. In the future, I hope that becomes pretty straightforward for like a community to do. There are multiple people who have and or are doing it on their own, which is awesome. So Bitcoin Jungle was an example. They forked the Bitcoin Beach wallet in less than 3 weeks. They had it ready to go in the App Store. So they made a couple changes, and now they're still building on it. And I mean, the beauty of open source software. So Lee from Bitcoin Jungle, and now they're working with Francis Puyot from Bull Bitcoin, implementing like on ramp and off ramp in country. That you probably have saw. There's a section called Earn where you can learn about Bitcoin and earn some satoshis in the app. It started out as 4 chapters, and now there's like 20 chapters. We added a bunch of content. But Lee was the one that actually built it into the app and then raised the PR so that we could get it upstream into the Blink wallet. And so we have people who are building on the Galois stack, contributing back to the wallet, making the wallet better. And so you have Dread, Pole Vault Dream. He also has a podcast called One Love Bitcoin. He's building an app using the Galois stack as well. And you have a couple other apps that are launching. So I think it's still a little bit early, and it's still a little bit like, if you think about, you're in like UI and design and stuff, if you think about like WordPress or like the web development tools, like, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, like you could do it, but like it wasn't what it is today. You didn't have your Squarespaces of the world that you're, or if you think about cloud computing, you know, push button, AWS, you know, just getting like servers up and running with like a couple clicks, like, this is possible, you know, down the road. It's not where you are today. You need to have some development skills in the languages that the repos are written in. And so in the short term, I think it's you know, enterprise organizations that say are starting to be like, okay, this bull market's coming back. Like, are we gonna do something about Bitcoin? You know, you got 13 ETFs in the US and people, you know, you have a lot of interest coming into Bitcoin. I use an example, like, you know, pick your example. The other day I was using like Home Depot or something like this, like, you know, or Starbucks or something, you know, like any of these organizations, like the stack that we're building is to the standard of, you know, what these, you know, Fortune 500 organizations, I think, you know, would expect of like continuous integration and continuous delivery and like highly available and scalable. And the dev team at Galloway is extremely impressive. I'm excited about some of the things that we're working on that we'll be talking about and kind of sharing more broadly later in the year. It's funny working at a company building open source, because you build in the open, like, the, you know, nothing's a secret if you want to go find it out. But we have some cool parts of the stack that'll be kind of coming together and you know, sharing a little later in the year.
Yeah, that's exciting. Are you guys working with Liquid at all? Is that something that's on your roadmap or in your...
We're not working with Liquid today. We don't also don't have it on any sort of roadmap to speak of. I find it. I'm very interested, and I'm like watching. And I guess the way I'm seeing it is that I kind of mentioned this before, but like, the Bitcoin adoption toolbox is large, right? And you have Zeus, Phoenix, Breeze, Blixt, Aqua now, which, you know, with Liquid is you know, a very neat option. A number of others. And Blink, I think, is kind of really meeting a use case and in a powerful tool. I'm watching what the rollout with Aqua, you know, who starts to gravitate towards it and how it tends to be useful. So Blink is a custodial wallet, right? And so, I don't believe that custodial is a bad term, as long as you're clear about that. And as a custodian, you should be promoting self-custody as well. So we've been doing more like promotion around like, make sure you learn about self-custody, make sure and there's more features that you can build in to say like auto withdrawals or like, hey, like, have you learned about self-custody yet? You know, education and stuff. And so we are a custodial wallet. I think there are many tools in the toolbox that are kind of like trying to carve out this space of like, is it custodial or is it not? Is it semi? Is it? I think anything that you're not in full control, anything with the counterparty risk is, you know, is arguably not custodial or arguably not self-custodial. And so, there's a spectrum, and I think people are understanding that, but as it comes to Liquid, I'm just like an observer right now. I'm just kind of like I'm dabbling a little bit, and I'm just watching to see how people interface with it.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been playing around with Aqua as well, and I think you're absolutely right. It's a tool set, and what we're really seeing is an unbundling of what's possible, because as it currently stands, and this is the problem with the legacy system, even in New Zealand, is even if we want better features, we want something like Wise, but within, normal banks in New Zealand, it's simply not possible. But what's really great is, in Bitcoin, we can build this stuff and we can have self-custodial options for people. We can have custodial options. You pick your flavor. And that's really kind of the innovation here. And so I think you're absolutely right. Each community can choose what it wants to use. And the fact that they're all interoperable is really the great thing. And it really can enable that bottom-up adoption as well, because not having to have any infrastructure or anything, that you can just run it on your feature phone or your smartphone and get up and running. That's really powerful for bootstrapping it in communities. And then there's other things you can do once people are more established. But absolutely, the toolbox approach, the spectrum of options, optionality is really important.
Yeah, I think got a friend in Namibia, Oaken, who I always reference, because over here in Bitcoin Twitter, we're always like, we're always, brawling about, that's not Bitcoin. You spent from a custodial wallet. And he has a slide in his presentation that says, download both Bitcoin apps. And it has a QR for Blink and a QR for Blue Wallet. And he explains in his sessions, when he's teaching complete normies who've never barely heard of, know what Bitcoin is, hey, there are different types of wallets, and you should learn about different types of wallets and when each is most useful. That's kind of where I sit, is like, I love to see what, Zeus and, Greenlight, Kristen Decker and with Breeze and everything, what they're doing. And I have high respect for, because, and they'll even say it, it's like, we're fighting an unwinnable battle against custodial UX, right? Like but nevertheless, they persist, and you're getting lightning addresses. You're getting these things that previously were only available in custodial, in a mostly self custodial or very more frictionless way. So I believe that the gap is closing, and that the self custodial lightning wallets are getting better and better and better and better in terms of like the UX and the things that you can do that people want to do with payments on Lightning. And then I do believe that it's up to custodial wallets to be open source, to push self-custody or to teach about self-custody. We've even had explorations. We have some designs. We've talked to SeedSigner about having, a vault, watch-only type integration in Blink. And so, I think that is one thing where, I do believe that we should continue to close the gap so that it's not like, either or. It's just like, man, you have this toolkit, and as you evolve in your journey, you can just like customize the apps that work for you for the different use cases, for sure.
Yeah, I love it. Just zooming out a little bit, then coming back to some of your travels and your work with customer engagement, with marketing, with kind of education and all of that. You spent some time in El Salvador, other parts of the world. I'm just really interested in terms of like how Bitcoin has been received. You talk about the way people just kind of get it. And that's certainly not the experience in a lot of other places. But like, tell me just a little bit more about that. Like, any notable sort of moments that stand out to you when you see the kind of the lights go on in people's eyes as they understand what Bitcoin could mean for them?
Yeah, I mean, for people that are living in places where their money is being devalued, I think the most important thing is to like, use a Gladstein quote, like check your financial privilege, right? Or like just imagine the world that, I don't know what world you live in, but let's talk about the world I live in. Like, I've had jobs, each job has some 401k, and like, I'm literally just by going to work, I'm like saving money for retirement. Like, I didn't even like, it's like part of the law that you just have to like be made to save for retirement, right? And when some new asset comes along, like Bitcoin or some shitcoin, you're like, oh, should I not invest in this thing? I'd invest in this thing instead, because, and like the financial connectivity, and the same thing goes with like, oh, this is amazing. I can send money from me to you in seconds, you know, with no intermediary, and be like, yeah, well, I have Venmo and I have PayPal, and I have, we just have this like this glut of financial optionality for what we do. And you go to a place like, or, you know, El Salvador, one of the things that just shook me to the core in the early days, my early days of learning about what happened, I wasn't there in the beginning, but was, you know, Mike Peterson saying, you know, there's somebody, you know, they'd buy some extra cinder blocks if they had some extra cash, because they know that the price of cinder blocks only goes up. They know what the feeling of your money being devalued, and maybe I want to be adding a room onto my dwelling. And so I'm literally saving, the asset that I save in is cinder blocks, right? And so, you know, when I think about people who are getting it, it's like, it is magic to say, oh, I can send money from me to you, and that's it, right? Like I can, and not to mention, like, the thing that I think is key is you have this idea of a circular economy where, we can interact together and send digital payments and hold. But the way that you interact with other services, or even more importantly, other people in the world, I think is like changing the shape of the world. It's almost kind of bringing to life like the sovereign individual thesis, right? Because now you have a woman in Brazil who's teaching Portuguese to a kid in New York City, right? And the kid in New York City, or the kid's parents, are paying a third of what they would finding some local Portuguese teacher. The kid's getting a better education, arguably a better education, from somebody who literally lives in a village in Jericoacoara in Brazil. The woman, the teacher, is making double or three times maybe what she would be making doing some other thing, right, in her community. And so not only is she able to interact with her community and make digital payments, to hold Bitcoin and store value in something that is not melting away from her, but now she can interact with the world and communicate in the single language that, like, you know, the president of a country and a beggar on the street have, you know, the same rights to. And so I think that people, for when you have the right teacher, for lack of a better thing, somebody who like, I think that they're very effective at getting people on board. And this is, we've seen this with, you know, country after country, Uganda and these people who are just saying like, man, like, they're really getting people excited about this and building communities, like the town of Berlin, Nikki and James, like the entire community of Berlin is a 25,000 person, like it's a city. It's like, it's not a small village. And they brought like a bus of like 30 people to Adopting Bitcoin conference, all these like newbies. And there's a lot of engagement and excitement because the community thing says, wait a minute, can we use this thing and store our value in Bitcoin? But we can actually grow tourism and connect, yeah, with this, you know, this world, you know, of Bitcoiners. And so they're very excited about it. And they're actually going to have some events around the halving, which I think are just going to be amazing. I think that it's almost a year since that project started. And it's been, it's been really something else. And so, and the other thing is, like a stable sats or something like this too. It's like, if you don't have the issue, right? If you're like, stable sats, like Bitcoin is my stable coin, like, you know, I only buy if I can hold for 4 years, like, right, there's just very different worldviews. And so when you go or you hear stories to these different places, there's just so much potential and hope and opportunity opened up via the idea of enabling digital payments, or the idea of being able to have not just the best asset in the world ever, but any asset at all, right? Like, because these folks are not buying homes, they're not buying stocks, they're not buying, right? Like, there are no other assets. And so I think that it's very, I think that they haven't learned the, to quote D++ the other day, the financial fuckery of the entire like financial system that we live in, where we, and I'll speak of myself, I have to unlearn a lot to get Bitcoin, or I had to unlearn a lot to get Bitcoin. And I think that a lot of the people that never really were welcome into the global banking system, they don't have to unlearn that. They just kind of, they get what scarcity means, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's almost like the way a lot of places just jumped over the personal computer and went straight to smartphones. And that sort of rollout was a lot smoother. You know, it's a lot more portable and easy to get your hands on. But that's exciting. So that, what you just described there, it's quite a beautiful vision for the world. Is that how you see hyperbitcoinization? Is that how Galois sees hyperbitcoinization, this kind of universal currency, this kind of removing of barriers and this connectivity? Or
I mean hyperbitcoinization, right?
What does it mean for you?
I guess when I think about hyperbitcoinization, I think about sort of the end of the journey or this some like larger inflection point. But what's really exciting for me is the in between, now and then, because what's happening is the people who've been left out, who can get Bitcoin just by literally hearing about it in a meetup and go, like, that's amazing. Like, why wouldn't I learn more about this? Are all like learning and just so there's a project called Bitcoin Data. It's based out of Kenya, but they do Bitcoin education, like centered around women. They started their sixth cohort, I think, like today, and I think they had like 100-something students. And I was like, this is, again, only a year old. Like, all of these things are just blowing up. And meanwhile, you have like these curmudgeon, you know, people, you know, in the States or wherever else, and they're like, I don't know about this. Is it going up? Is it going to? It's dead. It's failed. And so meanwhile, like, these people are just munching up sats, you know, a couple sats at a time. You know what I mean? And so I think two things, like, back to the idea of hyperbitcoinization. One, number of people go up is like the thing that I get really excited about. Is like, I just get really excited about more people learning about Bitcoin. Like, I don't really care about governments as much adopting it or ETFs and stuff. It's all fun and like, but to look at and speculate, but I just really like to see this slow trickle of like people learning about Bitcoin. And also, I don't know when, like, our the financial system is headed for collision, right? Like, one of the books that I tell people to read, if they're like, what should I, you know, I'm like, first read Price of Tomorrow, by Jeff Booth. It is not a Bitcoin book. It doesn't mention Bitcoin until like the last page. But if you agree with his thesis, which is that something must break because the system, the way the system designed, is not sustainable, then you will find Bitcoin as the answer. And a thought experiment that I can't help but play out is that, say we go through a massive banking crisis a la 2008 or Great Depression or otherwise, there's no place in the world I would rather be than in Kampala, Uganda, or in Mossel Bay, South Africa, because what I'm seeing is we're like a bunch of electricians and we're wiring up the world for like Bitcoin, for a Bitcoin standard or hyperbitcoinization, but the power's not really on yet, right? The liquidity is not really there. The need isn't always fully there, but like the day the power goes on, like, yeah, exactly. Like, watch out, because if heaven forbid another Silicon Valley Bank or Silvergate Bank, like, this thing happens and like, once we run out of, like, you know, we're pressing on the brakes, you know, with our these different like policies that we try and like stamp out the crises with, any of these communities, any of these 20, 30, 40 communities around the world that are like maybe 30% Bitcoinized can go to 100% in like days. They can just be like, oh, hey, everybody, download this wallet and like accept Bitcoin, like, you know, and you know, I may be overstating it a bit, but I really do think that like the places and the people that are adopting Bitcoin today will be in a really, really good position in the next, you know, number of years. And like, and so like, there's nowhere I'd rather be, than working with those people and helping them build their knowledge and, you know, their education.
Yeah. Thank you. I love it. That's a story of the resilience that can come from these kinds of places. And it's an interesting vision, turning the power on and seeing what happens, because I think we have almost gotten used to this kind of crabbing along and just sort of things are happening. But I certainly say to a lot of people, there's so much building that's happened in the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years that's starting to come online. And couple that with different, macro things that are happening, it really feels like, we're building the lifeboats, we're building the technology to make it all happen and be ready for it when the time comes. One final
And
question
what
for
a
you. Oh, sorry.
and what and, sorry, I was just gonna say, and what a privilege. Everybody wants, just going to memes, number go up, going crazy. It's fun times, bull market, but like what a privilege to be able to just have this crab time. There's more and more and more and more people get downloading Blink. There's more and more. I see, every exchange is like we're blowing away our old numbers. Like the people are here. The price is kind of just waffling here and there, and that's fine. Like that's fine because like yeah, like you said, we have this time, and when the power goes on, it's better to have more people involved. But go ahead, I cut you
Yeah,
off.
1.21 gigawatts. Just one final thing for you, Andrew. You also talk about you do a bit of woodworking. I just wanted to maybe close on that and talk about sort of the craft and what that means for you.
Yeah, I was oh so yesterday I was fixing my wife's KitchenAid mixer, right? And I take it apart, and I'd never done this before, but I'm like, and she bought it secondhand. Like, we're Bitcoin, we don't spend any money. Like, we're not interested in new things or consumerism or whatever. But I'm working on this thing, and I'm like, man, this is first of all, it's a little fun. There's a bunch of gears, and one of them is made out of plastic, which helps it fail well, right? And so you get a $5 new gear, and essentially, I'm thinking like, this is kind of like playing with Legos, and I'll come back to the story. But like, the point was like, man, you grow up and you're handed kits of Legos, and you're like, I'm gonna just build stuff for life, and then next thing you realize, you're just staring at a screen, like, all the time for your whole life, and you're like, well, man, I was sold a bill of goods. Like, I want to, like, so for me, like, I need like real world contact with like making things. And so woodworking is a thing I like to do of any type, whether it's we've made a bed, I've made some shelves for my wife, and made some different little products. One thing, I don't know if I have it here, it's over there, but I make little like phone holders or whatever. I like to tinker. And so I do that with wood, but also we're doing a lot of renovations in our house, and we're doing those ourselves, so making trim. And so this is just like what I do to get away from a screen. I'm still usually listening to like a Bitcoin pod or something like that, but I would say like it's interesting because learning about B Bitcoin, many of the principles or the things that I already held matched well to some of the like the Bitcoin thinking of like, despite having a career in marketing and advertising, I was like never one to being like consumer, like just buying, like I just don't like to just buy things. Like my cars are 20 years old. I like old things that can be fixed simply. I hate this planned obsolescence. This shelf I built for my wife, we found this chestnut wood, which was from like an 1800s farmhouse, and we paid less for that wood than what you would get like this garbage at the store for. Like the same amount of wood today, you could get this like new cheap wood, and I'm like, why is this just why is it like this? Like what? And to me, it's, I mean, why it's like this? Because the fiat standard, and everything is broken and built on this unsustainable growth. And so, we actually am working. I'm working on. We have a little bit of a property. I'm trying to grow some. Trying to get into sort of like the permaculture, regenerative agriculture, and like, you talk about hyper-Bitcoinization. Like, in the future, hyper-Bitcoinization. Like, I want to be out building things. I want to be working in dirt. I want to be building community. In real life, shaking hands with people. And so, yeah, wood is w working with wood is. I mean, it's beyond therapeutic. It's very like, I think it's engaging for the mind. I never realized until I started building things how bad like nails and like metal and wood are like very weak, right? But if you build a strong joint like that you know really uses the properties of wood that are the strength. It's just there's nothing better and super satisfying. So.
Yeah. Well, just one more thing. Pulling on that, you talk about permaculture, and I'm actually currently in Japan, and got a lot of friends here involved in permaculture, which is sort of interesting because you think it's kind of a very urbanized place. But I'm hopefully going to give a presentation on how Bitcoin and permaculture kind of connect, because there is so many connections. And I think that's a whole market there as well, because those people get it. And I mean, you know what I'm talking about, like the ability to create systems, you know, locally sourced food, you know, the ability to maybe even put some Bitcoin miners into a greenhouse and have solar panels and all of that stuff. It's kind of more broadly like this kind of solar punk vision of how we can use technology to empower us instead of enslave us. And so I think that's another kind of a bit of a sleeper, because there's a huge amount of people out there, possibly more than there are Bitcoiners, who are very interested in, you know, sustainability, permaculture, these kind of ideas.
100%. I mean, so every Sunday, there's a guy goes by Jimmy, who has a Twitter space called Citadel Sunday, and he's building a ranch in Mexico. And with permaculture, and somebody reached out to him recently and started helping him to figure out the design, where he'd been kind of winging it. And this person with 20-30 years of experience started helping. And he goes, you got to reach out to Andrew. And so this guy reached out to me, and my mind has been absolutely blown. It's only been a past week or so, with this new information. I've been reading books and stuff, but, and one concept I would, you know, build on what you were talking about is, he's just like, let's just get down to the inputs and outputs.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh my God. And like inputs being like water, or like, you know, lumber, and outputs being sawdust or noise, right? Or something like this. And you're just like, and you're thinking about, like you said, with Bitcoin miners, like, and the idea of Bitcoin mining seeking out, you know, cheap energy, right? It's like Bitcoin miners being a consumer, right? Of, you know, to get your full potential out of electricity generation and stuff. And I think that something about this permaculture space, I would agree with you, is just like, it's so aligned just being efficient with your time and energy. Because part of it is also like, don't kill everything and then plant stuff and inject a bunch of chemicals and then do it again next year. Like, build a system that lasts. And it's just,
Yeah, and if you look at the origins of permaculture, you know, in modern times, looking at Bill Mollison, who wrote the book a bit effectively, an Australian guy who sort of, you know, outlined how you can do it, how you can make use of natural landscape, rainfall, runoff, all of this stuff. There's another chapter in there about how you put Bitcoin in there, and it's happening. So I think I maybe that could be a future episode to look at, but I think the connections between permaculture and Bitcoin are very strong, and I look forward to giving this presentation in Japan to a couple of these friends, because it's sort of much more than Bitcoin acceptance here that I've seen, is this idea of like permaculture, going back to the land, kind of building small communities, getting out of the cities, these kind of decentralizing ideas. It's certainly an idea worth exploring.
100%. It's you may know the book One Straw Revolution is you know one of the books that I think are a must read. And I think it was a guy, if I'm not mistaken, in Japan who.
Fukuoka Masanobu. Yeah, One Straw
Revolution. This guy. Yep. And he's like, he just started planting rice and barley at the same time. And the barley would grow and it would protect the rice seeds and he'd harvest it. And then the rice would grow behind it. And it's like, it's just so beautiful.
Yeah. And there's a whole thing around urban, I don't know what they call it, like renegade plantings, where they make use of like streets and kind of little areas of dirt to actually grow things in the urban situation. I mean, there's a whole thing. And it really connects with this kind of community building, kind of resilience, all of these themes that we've covered today. But it's exciting stuff. I really appreciate your time, Andrew, and sharing what you're interested in, working on, what you are working on, what Galoy is doing. It's seeming very, very exciting, and I look forward to seeing more in the future.
thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you. All right, Ben. Thanks, and let's keep in touch.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.